This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What you're really buying from the airlines is speed, and the price you pay is higher fuel consumption.
Airplanes transport over 2.2 billion passengers a year, but they're also a significant contributor to climate change, producing approximately 600 million tons of carbon dioxide annually. One transatlantic flight for a family of four creates more CO2 than that family generates domestically in an entire year. And while the benefits of the smaller planet that airline travel has created are immeasurable, can it be justified in light of the potentially life-damaging effects of climate change? And if we can't justify it, are we capable of stopping? George Monbiot writes, "When it comes to flying, there seems to be no connection between intention and action. This is partly because the people who are most concerned about the inhabitants of other countries are often those who have traveled widely." This week on Sea Change Radio, the first part of our two-part series on air travel. We speak with two veterans of the airline industry to learn more about what steps airlines are taking to lessen the environmental impact of this revolutionary mode of transportation. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Dave Swaranga. He's the retired chief economist for the Air Transport Association. Dave, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, glad to be here.
So what would you say to someone, Dave, who's telling you that flying is one of the least environmentally friendly things that one can do?
Well, I'd have to say that there's another view, which is when you're buying speed, you're improving your own efficiency. So it's a trade-off for one kind of efficiency versus another. The airline industry as a whole is responsible for about 2% of the greenhouse gases that are produced. You know, a significant number, but the airline industry is working hard to constantly improve that.
And what are some of the more significant steps the industry on the whole is taking to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases it produces?
Well, principally, two things that have occurred over my career. I started in the industry in 1970, and at about that time, the airlines were getting about 11 or 12 passenger miles per gallon, and today that number is over 40 passenger miles per gallon. So tremendous improvement in the efficiency of the aircraft. Now that's, I said there were two things that were involved in that. One is when the industry buys new airplanes, each new airplane they buy is certainly more fuel efficient than the one that's being replaced. And then the second factor is that when the industry was deregulated in 1978, the average passenger load factor was about mid-50s. The regulatory standard was 55%. Today, that number is around 80%. So it's a much, much more efficient utilization of the principal asset, the aircraft, and the one that generates the most of the greenhouse gases.
As you mentioned, Dave, the airlines are always trying to get high occupancy levels in order to increase their fuel efficiency and boost profits. So tell our listeners why it sometimes costs less to take a 3 or 4 leg itinerary from, let's say, Portland, Maine to Elko, Nevada, than a more direct route.
You're not going to ever find a direct flight between those two cities because there's simply not enough passenger demand. And the hub and spoke system was designed specifically to deal with this issue. So you can load in Portland, Maine, passengers that are going to many different destinations and fly them to a hub. Maybe that hub is going to be Boston. Maybe it's going to be Newark. Maybe it's going to be Cleveland. But you fly them to the hub, and there the passengers disperse on many flights going to many other destinations, and you connect on towards your final destination. It's the hub and spoke system. If you look at distribution systems, not just the airlines, but almost any kind of distribution system, ocean shipping, if you look at the railroads, if you look at telephone industry, communications industry, you find that hub and spoke systems are the most efficient and effective way of serving the most passengers. There are some cities that just simply can't sustain nonstop travel. And you'll find generally it's cheaper to fly nonstop than it is to fly connections. If you have a nonstop that competes with a multi-stop, then you're going to find that the people who are offering a multi-stop have to lower their prices because they don't have as good a product.
I don't think most people have a problem with a hub and spoke system, but they have the problem with what you're talking about here in this scenario where somebody, quote unquote, doesn't have as good a product because they don't have a direct flight from point A to point B. So you have to go to point C and D to get to point B, right?
Exactly. And so what they do, because their product isn't as valuable, they lower the price. And so what you find is that it's not a price that's based on the cost for the carrier to provide the service, but it's a cost based on the value of the product. In other words, to market set price.
And bigger airlines can have generally a better, quote-unquote, better product because they have more flights to more destinations.
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, if you look at air service in the United States, there's probably about 20 cities in the entire country that account for over 80% of air travel. And you will find that between those 20 cities, there's almost always nonstop. Any one of the 20 to any of the other 19, you will find probably that nonstop service exists. It's when you get into some of the smaller cities, and I mentioned Elko, Nevada specifically because when the industry was regulated, the airlines were required to provide service to Elko, Nevada. And, you know, so carriers ran a 727 into that town a couple times a day, and they had no passenger loads that would really have justified that kind of service. So that kind of city is now connected to the rest of the world through hubs, and that's generally done with a size airplane that will accommodate frequent service to the hub, and then from the hub, many destinations.
Before Southwest was hatched, what do you think they were thinking was going to give them a chance to compete with the big boys?
Two principal things. They had much lower labor costs and still do to this day. That's the principal advantage that they have. Secondly, most of the startup carriers have opted to, at least most of the successful startup carriers have opted to use a single aircraft type. And that means their training costs are lower. You don't have pilots constantly moving from one aircraft type to another. And their maintenance costs were lower because they had standardized inventory and that sort of thing.
That's why I guess going to an international model is a big, big leap because then you need a different fleet.
Exactly, exactly. And surprisingly, though, I have expected, and it has not really occurred, that these low-cost carriers would form connections with other low-cost carriers around the world and with some kind of hub-and-spoke operation be able to feed an international aircraft that would make a lot of sense. Now, one of the reasons why that hasn't happened is that prices were very low on international routes because carriers were using very efficient aircraft and labor costs spread out over a long-haul flight generally is not the make-or-break cost of that flight. When you're flying a 747 with 300 passengers on it, the cost of your labor spread out over those 300 passengers gets to be a smaller component of the operating cost versus, let's say, fuel. And so it was harder for the startup carriers, the low-cost startup carriers, to enter into a market where they did not have a significant cost advantage.
Oh, well, in Sunday morning, when this life is over, I'll fly away, we'll fly away, I'll fly away, well, into my home on God's celestial shore. Tell Mother and I, I'll fly away, we'll fly away, I'll fly away, early one day, and I'll fly away, I will fly away,
I'll fly away,
oh, Lord, and I'll fly away, I will fly away,
I'll fly away,
oh, Lord, and when I die, hallelujah,
by and by,
tell Mother and I,
I'll fly away,
oh, we'll fly away,
I'll fly away,
oh, one day, and
I'll fly away,
we'll fly away,
I'll fly away,
oh, Lord, and
I'll fly away,
I will fly away,
I'll fly away.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest today is retired chief economist of the Air Transport Association, Dave Swaranga. Dave, let's get back to the sustainability issues surrounding air travel. So you had mentioned that the industry has been able, through technology, has been able to improve average fuel consumption from 12 miles per gallon to 40 and higher, 40 miles per gallon today in the newer airplanes. Sounds pretty good. When you're buying a car, 40 miles per gallon is a decent mileage rate, right?
Yeah, that's with one person in one seat. Now, when you put two people in a car, the advantage swings to the automobile, and what you're really buying from the airline is speed. And the price you pay is higher fuel consumption.
But shouldn't we really be comparing air travel to train travel? I mean, automobile, so people are more used to hearing about miles per gallon when it comes to their cars because they fill up their cars by themselves. But this is, it's apples to oranges because that's an individual usage, universally thought of as a fairly inefficient way to travel. But some mass transit systems like both regular rail and high-speed rail might be more apt comparisons. Do you know what kind of miles per gallon rates generally train travel uses?
I know that in the Washington, D.C. to New York to Boston corridor that the train was a pretty effective competitor to the airlines. They were able to compete on time and price in a market that was, let's say, up to about 3 or 4 hours. Beyond that, the airlines had a clear advantage, both price and time.
But not in terms of emissions, obviously.
Probably not, no. But when you get to high-speed rail, emissions, of course, rise. And what is required for high-speed rail to be really effective is that they have to have high-speed corridors into city centers, and they don't. The problem is that the curves that are in the track are much too sharp in the existing infrastructure to accommodate high speed. And so when the city outskirts arrive, high-speed rail disappears. So in order to get an effective high-speed rail connection in the United States and, let's say, do it New York to Chicago, where there might be enough passengers to sustain that, or San Francisco to Los Angeles, you still have a problem with infrastructure costs that are far, far greater than airline infrastructure.
And unless
costs.
That's highly subsidized, that leads to prices that are not really even competitive with air travel. We've seen that in lots of parts of Europe and Asia, where if you have a high-speed train that people might prefer to take, not only for the convenience, but also for the environmental impact, but the airlines in those places are actually kind of carving them up in terms of price, right?
Yeah, I know that in Europe, the rail systems are much, much more extensive than they are here in the United States. But on the other hand, the cities are much closer together in general. But when you look at low-cost air service, you know, Ryanair has flights that are incredibly cheap in Europe, and the rails just can't compete with that.
Even though you've worked in the industry and believe in air travel as one of the best options for people in terms of time and convenience, and we all agree that air travel is a wonderful thing in most respects, it is generally by far the least eco-friendly option, right?
Well, I'm not willing to entirely concede that point because I think that the U.S. airline industry has made tremendous strides in improving their efficiency. And even though the automobile has become much more efficient over the same years that I've been talking about, they are not as efficient if you have a single passenger in a car as the airlines are. And so, you know, if you're talking about the businessman who generally is in the car by himself making a trip, when the trip gets to be more than an hour or two, he's going to seriously consider taking the airplane, not only because it's cheaper than driving, and it often is, more expensive to drive than it is to fly. It's also faster, and what you're really buying is efficiency of your own time.
Right. No, there's no question it's the shortest way to travel in this country. But those short flights are particularly energy guzzling, aren't they? Because the takeoff and landing require so much extra energy.
Well, that's exactly right. And so the longer haul the flight is, the more efficient the airplane becomes. And in fact, that's one of the airline's strategies in conserving fuel, is to maximize the amount of time that the flight spends at high-altitude cruise, and then it makes a more sharp descent to the airport. That is the most fuel-efficient way to fly that. And by the way, there are a lot of other things that are on the horizon here that are going to increase aircraft efficiency even without any additional investment in aircraft. And I'm talking about the air traffic control system, which is run by the federal government. Today's system is based on you flying the aircraft over specific checkpoints on the ground. And so when you fly from Los Angeles to New York, you do not fly in a straight line, but you fly over these checkpoints. It's kind of a zigzag flight. And with a new air traffic control system that's on the horizon, a little more control is going to go into the aircraft cockpit, which will allow the pilot to select his destination and fly straight to that destination, no zigzags. And that's going to increase fuel efficiency. And in addition, he's going to be able to opt the most efficient altitude based on winds aloft. You know, there are some high-speed winds, and you can take advantage of those high-speed winds if you have a nice tailwind, or you can avoid them by flying at different altitudes if you're flying into them. So you know, there are things that are going to happen in the next decade that I think we'll see another spurt in efficiency of the air transport system. Something you probably can't see is when the airplane taxis, it's now probably only using a single engine to power the airplane away from the gate and out to the runway, and then powers up that engine when it needs it, that second engine. So that's something that you probably can't see, but is happening, another fuel efficiency measure that the airlines are taking. And then just watch when they plug that airplane in at the gate, you can see them attach the power cables. And right there, you know that aircraft is using ground power instead of its own auxiliary power, which is much, much more efficient.
You mentioned how at higher altitudes, it's more efficient in terms of time, but there's been a lot of studies in the last decade that are trying to set different standards for today's aircraft to fly at because of the contrails that form, I guess. These are the colder the air, the more likely contrail formation becomes at higher altitudes.
And what that does is it prevents sunlight from getting to the Earth's surface, and so it actually cools the Earth unnaturally.
Today's aircraft generally fly, I think, around 35,000 feet. Is that right?
Yeah, that's typical.
But there's been ceilings that have been recommended. I read a British study that said the summertime, 31,000 feet would be more optimal, and in the winter, 24,000 feet to try to reduce contrails. And this would obviously slightly increase travel time, but that trade-off is one that could be really important in terms of the environmental impact. What do you think the airlines are doing to try to find that balance between time efficiency and environmental impact?
Well, one of the chief things is what I had already mentioned, and that is that when you fly at the higher altitudes, you can take advantage of the jet stream. And so you reduce fuel consumption significantly if you're flying with a jet stream tailwind. So you're trading off flying at a lower altitude and not being able to take advantage of that, and consequently producing more greenhouse gases and maybe less in the way of contrails. So one is greenhouse gases are going to warm the atmosphere. Contrails are going to cool it. So you got to decide which way you want to head here.
Well, it sounds like the balancing act that the airlines have to find is similar to what a concerned consumer has to find when they try to weigh all the options when travel. Well, Dave Swaranga, he is a consultant whose website is aerocon.com. That's AEROECON.com. He's the retired chief economist for Air Transport Association. Dave, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
All right, and thanks for this opportunity, and hope to see you in an airport someday.
Engine start. Whole lot playing this morning. Please, please don't let those jet engines start.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
My guest on SeaChange Radio is Bob McAdoo. He's a senior airlines analyst at Avondale Partners. It's an institutional brokerage. He's worked in the airline industry for over 35 years. Bob, welcome to SeaChange Radio.
Good to be here.
Bob, can you talk about how you see airlines dealing with rising fuel costs down the road in the decades ahead?
Well, there's really two or three things that have happened, have happened and continue to happen. I think there has been there's constant pressure on the manufacturers to come up with ways to make airplanes more efficient. And more efficient, you know, in some respects, I guess you could say getting a bigger airplane is more efficient because you still only have two pilots. Maybe that's one kind of efficient. But one of the other things is if you see airplanes flying, you see an airplane sitting in an airport, and out at the end of the wing, they've got these pieces of metal that flip up that maybe go 2, 3, 4, 6, 8 feet tall out on the end of the wing, depending on the type of airplane. I mean, those are the kinds of things that have come around which reduce the burn, fuel burn, up to 4 or 5%, believe it or not. Having extra weight, extra length on that wing, and having it tip up at the end, and don't ask me to explain how because I'm not an engineer, but that actually causes it to go through the air smoother, easier, and saves fuel. So you see those kind of things. The other thing you see is take a company like Continental Airlines, which has focused on keeping a very modern fleet and continue to upgrade their fleet probably more rapidly than others. You know, as I recall, the amount of fuel that they burn now for each mile that they pull a seat through the sky is down something like 20% versus what it was a few years ago. You know, so there's still people who have some things to do in terms of getting up to speed that way, in terms of current technology. Just like, you know, a 1974 Pinto is a very small car, but it only got about 18 miles to gallon, where that same size car today, with today's technology, would be a 35 or 40 mile per gallon car. The same thing goes. You have a 100-passenger airplane that's 30 years old versus a new 120-passenger airplane. You're going to burn 15, 20% less fuel just because of different, you know, more modern engines and what they've learned about how to shape the wings and whatever. So that is one thing. You know, the other thing is, how do you, you know, so there will continue to be those kind of pressures. And there is a new generation of engines that Pratt & Whitney, part of UTX Corporation, is coming out with, that in another 2 or 3 years is again supposed to take another 15 to 20%, as I understand it, off a fuel burn. So there are those things. They are expensive. Not everybody can afford to do them. The other thing that happens is that, you know, as the price of fuel goes up and you have to try to, you know, not spend all your money on fuel, you know, you say, gee, the price of something, my costs go up, therefore I need to raise the price. Well, you can't just raise the price of all the tickets 20-25% to cover the cost of fuel that's doubled, if that's what were to happen. So what has happened is that the airlines have figured out that one of the ways to deal with this is to actually reduce the number of seats they offer. You know, like, instead of having 4 flights a day, 7 days a week, maybe it's 4 flights a day, 5 days a week, and a couple days a week they don't operate. So they squeeze down the number of seats, the number of departures, and therefore the number of seats that they're offering in the market. When you do that, one of the things that is clear, I think we've all noticed, is there's some people, sometimes you get a $400 ticket, some people pay $300, some $200, all in the same flight, and maybe there'll be some people at $99 and some people at $49. You know, and with that, what happens is, if you squeeze down the amount of service you have in a market, what happens is you, in effect, have to squeeze off, you know, the guy who is the $49 guy maybe doesn't get a seat because we just don't have enough seats left for him. We're gonna save the seats for the higher priced guy. That gives you the ability to raise the average ticket by not having any $49 guys on the flight anymore. It raises the average ticket without having the other 90% of the people have to pay more.
One thing that I also read about was that the cost of these high-end tickets, the first class and the executive class tickets, are the carbon footprint of those are significant because they take away seats on the plane.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, when you think about it on an airplane, I mean, think about the basic economics of the business is that, you know, you're in effect renting space. It's no different than, you know, renting a one-bedroom versus a four-bedroom apartment, you know, in a building. You know, you're renting more space when you have the fancier ticket, you know, the bigger ticket. And so, you know, in effect, you could, although I've never heard anybody actually do it this way, you could, in fact, just sitting here thinking out loud, you could do a calculation that was, you know, pounds of fuel burned per square foot or per square inch or whatever on the plane. And you know, with that, sure enough, you would, you know, you would clearly burn more fuel for the big seat with lots of leg room and the ability to lay out flat and all that, simply because you are consuming many more square feet than those who sit in the back and have our neighbor's elbows and our ribs.
Bob McAdoo, Senior Airlines Analyst with Avondale Partners in Kansas City. Bob, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been enjoyable. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Steve Miller Band, the CBS Trumpeteers, and Buddy Guy. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast.
Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.